The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Overheard is an opportunity for us to share some of the audio that catches our respective ears. For this month's segment, we cast the net wider to get audio picks from other folks we work closely with here at NHPR. With me today is Sam Evans-Brown. He's NHPR reporter and host of Outside In. Also, Sarah Plour, digital producer and designer here at NHPR. She is also the producer of the 10-Minute Writers Workshop. Sam, we'll start with you. What have you got?
So I've got this little lovely podcast that I found through another podcast. It's called The World According to Sound. It's by two producers out in California, and it's basically just audio. They find interesting clips of sound, they describe them, but only very minimally, and then they give you about 60 seconds of that sound, and you just sort of sit with it.
So, okay, are they aping our stuff here? I mean, what? Sounds like Overheard.
Yeah, well, let's give a listen to one of them. The first one that I wanted you to hear, it's the sound of sand dunes.
This is a sand dune. Physicist Zimon Dagwa-Boy recorded this dune in Oman. The sound is made by countless grains of sand rubbing together and vibrating as they roll down the dunes. In this desert, the sand particles vary in size, so you hear all different notes. But in this Moroccan desert, each grain of sand is almost identical, so the dunes sing a constant note, G sharp.
Wow, have they got the... where are they recording it from? Like the surface or inside? I can't tell.
I think it's right on the surface. I mean, you don't... And this is part of what's sort of lovely about it, is that the description is so minimal. I mean, if you really want to know more, it's incumbent on you to go find more, because that's it. I mean, we just listened to a whole episode right there.
Really? The whole episode is just sand?
That's just it. And then each episode, they have one sound. For instance, we've got another quick clip. We won't listen to the whole thing. We'll just listen to the sound. This one is athletic grunts. So here's what I like about this.
I think I recognize some of this.
Yeah, exactly. So here's what I like about this, which is they aren't afraid of you getting maybe just a little bit bored. The sound runs a little longer than it's allowed to run in a lot of podcasts. So they're challenging some of the conventions of radio in that way. But also, they're just playing to radio's strengths. I mean, what is audio good at? It's good at taking you to places that you wouldn't have cause to go otherwise, at letting you experience things that you would have no way of doing so if you weren't for your little audio device.
That's terrific. What's the name of the podcast again?
The World According to Sound.
And the world in a grain of sand, as we hear. Sarah Plourd, what have you got for us?
So I discovered a little while ago this wonderful podcast out of Baltimore, where I used to live, Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City. And it's one of the projects funded through AIR and Local Lore.
AIR is the Association of Independents in Radio, by the way.
Yes, thank you. And so this is just an open to a recent episode from June that I felt was particularly well produced.
It's Friday, Paycheck Friday. And you know what that means.
Wake up, wake up, wake up, it's the first step, wake up. Get up, get up, get up, get up.
The weekend is about to be lit. All you have to do is cash your check and it's on. There's just one problem. You live in one of the many sections of Baltimore City where traditional bank branches are scarce. And for any number of reasons, from reliance on public transportation to lack of a state-issued photo ID or smartphone, you aren't a traditional bank account holder. That means no direct deposit and likely no savings account. But of course, there are other solutions. And those seem to be present on every other Baltimore City block, with neon blinking signs and awnings with big, bold letters. The check cashing place. The payday lender.
The voice is great. Who is the host?
So that's the host. Her name is Stacia Brown. I had the joy of connecting with her at Work It, the podcast festival in New York recently. And she's an independent producer. She's a single mom. And she's just, you know, she applied to AIR with this idea. And she, each episode, looks at a different sort of insider view of Baltimore. Like, the most recent episode looked at the Muslim communities in Baltimore, particularly the Black Muslim communities.
So what's interesting to me about it is, like, so often when we hear about the news, we hear, you know, sounds of the street, sounds of this, but this is just one narrator. So we kind of, I don't know, she invites us in a different way.
Yeah. And her, I mean, there's plenty of tape in her episodes. This is just part of the open, but she opens with these generally sound rich, well produced little almost monologues. So you get like a minute to a minute and a half at the beginning of each episode where she's kind of laying out the story. And they always hook me. Like, mm-hmm. they always hook me in like 5 seconds.
Tell me the name of the podcast again.
It's called Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City.
The Rise of Charm City. I have a piece of audio that historically addresses, you know, the problems of the inner city and divided America, which feels especially significant today. I heard this on Fresh Air, and it's an interview that Dave Davies did with a guy named Larry Tye. He wrote a book about Bobby Kennedy called The Making of a Liberal Icon. Now, up until this point in Bobby Kennedy's career, this is from 1968, he's on the campaign trail in Indiana, and he just found out when he got off the plane that Martin Luther King had been killed. So April 4th, what, 1968. And he's telling the crowd. And up until then, he had never sort of publicly shown any kind of emotionality about his own brother's death, what, 5 years before. So let's hear a little bit of this tape. It's long, but I think you can hang on to it.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country. So I ask you tonight to return home, to say a prayer for the family, Martin Luther King, yeah, it's true, but more importantly, to say a prayer for our own country, which all of us love. A prayer for understanding and that compassion that of which I spoke.
And that was Robert Kennedy speaking in 1968 to a crowd in Indianapolis right after the assassination of Martin Luther King.
That scream that, you know, that went up from the crowd. I mean, it's like, it makes you wonder how many people that was the first they had heard and how different that was from today, you know? I mean, imagine that crowd today, how many people would be on their smartphones and would have heard minutes after it happened.
It's such a powerful piece of tape. And one of the interesting things about it is Indianapolis is one of the places where there were not riots after Martin Luther King died. And he was warned by a local official, do not go into the inner city today and talk about this because bad things will happen, you won't be safe. And just to hear, you know, like his voice increasingly breaking, you know, that Boston Brahmin accent kind of breaking down. And you know, how confounding to be just reminded of like how screwed up our country still is about issues and divisions about race. It's kind of disheartening, but heartening at the same time in some way.
Mostly disheartening.
Yeah, mostly disheartening. I was just actually asking myself that, like, what's heartening about it? I think it's that somebody is talking about it, I don't know, in his own veiled way, that, you know, he's saying, my brother was also killed by a white man. This isn't just a race question. So, you know, sorry to end on a bit of a bummer note, but I really do feel like that message of say a prayer for this country, you know, whatever kind of way you want to pray, but that it shouldn't be about division. And I don't know. It just hit me.
And I think, too, maybe, you know, we've been through this before and there were triumphs that followed those horrible acts. So that's not to say that, you know, things that we heard last week are the end of the story.
The story goes on. So does a lot of great sound. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Urban renewal was a federal program introduced after World War II with the aim of clearing so-called slums from cities and making way for improved infrastructure and commercial development. The areas most often targeted were the city's working class, African American, and immigrant neighborhoods. Georgia Moody brings us this story of how urban renewal affected the Italian community of Portland, Maine.
Newbury Street was a world unto itself. You thought that the whole world was Italian, you know, and unfortunately it wasn't.
Portland, Maine's Little Italy. That's where we lived.
From 4th Street to Congress Street
and
from Mumford
Newbury Street, India Street,
probably
Mumford
up
Street,
to
Federal Street,
Vine Street, Deer Street,
Deer Vine and Chatham,
Chatham Street.
That was the heart of the Italian community. They had taken their little piece of Italy, their piece of heaven, and brought it here. And it lasted up until the 50s.
And then urban renewal came in and cut Little Italy right in half.
They just came in with bulldozers and it was gone. It was gone. The smells and the sights. Oof. You could walk down that street and you could smell anything you wanted to smell, from bread to pasta to meat.
You would see people sitting on their steps with their little cups of oil and hot, fresh Italian bread. I'm Giovanna Ricci.
My name is Camillo Luigi Breccia, and I grew up on 33 Newbury Street, right in the middle of Little Italy.
Teresa Attrapaldi, who was my grandmother, started the store at 47 India Street. And then we had Lefevre's store at 72 India Street, Cartonio's at 45, and Amato's at 71. So we had four Italian groceries within a block.
Each house had fig tree, apple tree, pear tree, plum tree, gardens. They all had gardens. And that's where most of the parties in the neighborhood took place.
My name is Lou Germani. I was born in 1922. Most of the Italians, they all congregated around the St. Peter's Church. We were baptized there. We made our communion there. We had our confirmation there. And a lot of us were married there in the church, see?
Most of the noise that was in that area was from Thomas Laughlin, a big steel company that was right on Newbury Street. And if you were not brought up in that area, that noise would drive you crazy because it would be ba-boom,
ba-boom, ba-boom,
ba-boom. Little Italy was, even though it was mainly Italian, they were other families that lived there.
Off of Middle Street, there was a small Jewish community, and the Irish were sent mostly up the upper part of Montjoy Hill.
You know, and everybody got along fine. There was never any trouble.
On Newbury Street, next door to what used to be the synagogue, my Italian grandparents lived on the second floor on one side, and on the third floor were my Irish grandparents, and that's how my mother and father met. My name is Anne Balzano. That's my maiden name, Rand. We were far from wealthy, but we were not poor.
There was nothing that they didn't have. The houses were always maintained very nicely. Were they wealthy financially? Probably not. They worked. They were working people.
Carpenters, masons, bricklayers, plasterers. They believed working with their hands.
They were not high-income people, but they definitely was not a slum.
My name's Tom Vatlow, and I came to Portland in 1970 as the executive director of the Portland Urban Renewal Authority. At the end of World War II, America was transitioning from a wartime economy to a peacetime economy, saw slums in the big cities and said, something has got to be done. And out of this came a federally sponsored urban renewal program. Cities were allowed to ask the federal government for funding. And the idea was you would remove the slums and blight, have a new vacant property, and then private parties would come forward and be interested.
But there had to be a purpose for it.
A public purpose.
If it is, can be proved that it is for the greater good and it's absolutely necessary. And that process is called eminent domain.
Eminent domain is if you don't want to sell, the city has the right to take your property and give you what they feel they want to for it.
What they call fair market value. The first project that they were involved in was in Deer Vine and Chatham, and that took place in 1955.
Everybody was up in arms, and they went to the council meetings, and there was nothing we could do. The council had the last word. And everybody said, well, it must have been all said and done even before you told us about it.
These Italians built those houses, lived in those houses, and they planned to die in those homes. The city comes and takes the home, gives them $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. Where do they go?
That was it. And you were out.
Down went Chatham Street, down went Deer Street, down went Vine Street, and all of those people were displaced, us included.
You know, the houses were gone. They leveled everything. There was nothing there. It was vacant lots.
And what did they do with it? They built office buildings.
And now it's almost all commercial, the high-rise hotels, garages.
You destroyed a whole neighborhood to build that?
Grant you, the office buildings are giving people work and so forth, but you took part of us with you.
There was no closeness anymore. There was no kumara, kumpara next door that they could go and talk to.
Cremo's Bakery went out of business. Lawrence Spear's Meat Market closed up. Prevarada never reopened his store. The Jewish people that lived in the area of Little Italy had moved out of the area. And it was sad because after everybody scattered, you couldn't get together anymore.
You know, all of that which you treasured and all of that which is important to you, if somebody comes and says, what you have is substandard, it's no good anymore. You're not worth anything. It was awful. Awful, awful, awful.
The Urban Renewal Program, in the long run, got a bad name. We were not looking to benefit Company A or Company B or Company C. I think the overall community benefited greatly, and that was the intent.
I don't think there was anything really nefarious going on. I think that there was a lack of real consideration for the people with the glorious thought that we'll do this and everybody will be better off for it.
I'm not saying that they're bad people. I'm just saying that they made a tremendous mistake. You know, and they destroyed something that was absolutely beautiful. The house is a physical thing, but the closeness of a community, once you break that up, can never be replaced.
And that story was brought to us by Georgia Moody. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, it's official. Pokemon Go is a full-fledged phenomenon. In the week since its release, the augmented reality game has more daily active users than Twitter and more audience engagement than Facebook. Well, if you've been in a public space this week, you have definitely seen people walking around holding up their phones to snap virtual monsters. The game has been praised for getting people outside and moving around, something that naturalists and public health officials have been trying to do for years. But when it comes to developing an appreciation for the outdoors, will Pokemon Go make a dent? To find out, Sam Evans-Brown, host of NHPR's podcast Outside In, sat down with Maura Adams, program director at the Northern Forest Center, and Gray Chenoweth. He's chief operating officer at SilverTech. Producer Taylor Quimby could not help but join in.
I think I'm going to just start by letting you each tell me sort of what you know about Pokemon Go and how you feel about it as a way for people to get outside.
What I know about Pokemon Go is a little limited, I have to admit. I am very aware of the phenomenon and that apparently
only a week old, so I don't think anyone is really an expert yet.
But there are more people on Pokemon if it continues at their rate than Tinder and Twitter combined, apparently.
Intense.
So about how it relates to people getting outside, I mean, terrific. There's more ways for people to go walking and outdoors and not be in front of a computer, but like, I think if this is what our relationship with the outdoor world has come down to, like now we can't go outside and walk and experience nature unless it's like with our phone playing a stupid game that shows us little creatures in the woods that don't exist, like that's kind of sad.
Do you feel sadness?
I don't feel sadness. So the way that I find about Pokemon Go is I was on vacation last week, so I was spending kind of abnormally a lot of time on social media. And so I started to kind of pick up on the 6th, then the 7th, and then I started to see like a lot of people in my social feeds saying that they'd seen other people play it. So I was like, all right, I'm checking it out. So I downloaded it. And I was like immediately, I had the most powerful reaction to that, more powerful reaction to that than I had since downloading Meerkat or Periscope on Twitter. Just the sense that like, okay, this is like a real shift in the way that people are going to be doing things. And the way that I saw it being really powerful is it brings together a bunch of different forces that I think that are really happening in the world. So one of the forces is technology. And the other of the forces is the need to relate to people in the real world. We still want to be with people. We still want to engage with friends. We still want to do all that stuff. But we're using technology more and more and more to mediate it in the same way that I would argue we've been using technology all along. It just now is a different type of technology. So, you know, first we used shoes to allow us to walk further in nature. And then we used flashlights to kind of like be able to see in the dark in nature. And then we'd use like, you know, telescopes to be able to see further in nature. And
I do think telescopes predated flashlights. But okay, keep going. I didn't mean to.
Yeah, great point. You know, maybe torches, yeah. Right? Will you give me torches?
Yeah,
torches. So torches before telescopes. And so I think it's just this continuum of the way that we use technology to mediate our relationships with the outside world. I got into a little bit of a Twitter battle on this yesterday, and the final retort from the person I was debating with was, stars exist and Pokemon do not, right? And my response to that was, well, the constellations exist. If they do, then Pokemon exist.
But they're just a construct that we've made.
They're just a construct that we've made and applied to the natural world as a way to enjoy it. And if this is the next step in that, where I'm going to go to a really amazing spot on a trail because that's going to be a party spot for Pokemon Go.
It's called the Pokestop.
Let's
be accurate here.
All right. Thank you very much for correcting my language. But like, you know, if you get to that spot because of Pokemon Go, like, I think you got to be super careful about the normative judgments you draw about that.
But you have to admit, though, I mean, you're sort of filtering this from somebody with a tech background and probably a small element of appreciating sort of the business of it and like what a genius idea this was.
Mm-hmm.
But Maura, you're coming from this idea of trying to educate people to conserve the world that we do live in, you know, without any of the fantasy creatures, the real ones sometimes are in big trouble. And if we're paying attention to the wrong thing, there's a danger there. Is that what you're saying?
That's part of what I'm saying. Certainly there's, if you're not grounded in the water and the plants and the sun that support our existence, you can have all the fun little Pokemons you want. You're just not going to have a world to experience them in. I was thinking about your comments on technology as a mediator between ourselves and nature, and I was thinking about things like the apps where it can identify birdsong or it can identify plant based on the leaf. Like, that's cool. And even that, I'm a little skeptical. I'm like, shouldn't I have to pull out my botany book and, like, you know, key this out? Like, then I'm a real, like, plant person. But, okay, modern conveniences of technology are sometimes pretty good. And, like, if it can tell me that that's a
yellow-bellied sapsucker?
Yellow-bellied sapsucker. I'm like, sweet, now I know that that's a yellow-bellied sapsucker, and next time I hear that, I'll know, and I don't have to use my app. So there's a way to use it that's educational about the actual natural world that does bring us closer. Pokemon just puts, like, a thingy out there that has no relevance to the place which we come from.
My opposition to that point of view would be based on kind of like, I think it's rooted in the way that we think about the national park system. And a lot of that debate was around whether or not, you know, are we bastardizing nature by making it accessible? And some people would say no trails, no roads, no tent sites, no flashlights, no tents. You know, get out there and be in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And my suggestion is that I don't know if that's really realistic. And just because someone's a pugilistic naturalist doesn't mean that that's the right thing to happen. I would say, you know, a lot of people think national parks are a great way to get people outside because they make nature accessible for people and they give it people a pathway to enjoyment. You know, I think that there's a lot of great arguments to be made that Pokemon Go would be a pathway for enjoyment of the outside.
So here's my question, though, is do you think that those people who, you know, this is the first time they got outside all week because of Pokemon Go, you know, when the fad passes, which I'm sure it will, do you think that those people are actually going to continue to get outside because they've developed some sort of appreciation for being outside in these spaces?
Well, the way I would say it is that the only reason that Pokemon Go is popular is because people want to go outside. Right? They're looking for something to help them on that journey. If they only wanted to stay inside, Pokemon Go would, augmented reality wouldn't be a thing.
So, you know, I wouldn't argue that there's no upside to this. Like, I'm all for more people getting outside and people getting together and relating. What I have a real problem with is you say people want to get outside and people are just looking for an excuse to get outside. And if that's the case, why do all of a sudden they need some company to create some software that all of a sudden this is what they need to get outside? I think that's pretty sad. If there's such this human urge to get outside and experience the natural world and relate to others, why aren't they doing that already? And why are now, at this moment in society, you have to have an app to get you to do that?
Well, and I think too, what Moore's expressing is that we can talk about how the national parks were a way to make wilderness more accessible, and compare that to Pokemon Go, but that sort of ignores the fact that we have this broader trend of people getting out less and less. You know, if you look at visitation rates to national parks, they are in fact going up, but visitation per capita is going down. So what's actually happening is it's the same people going over and over again. Mm. Anyone who, you know, my wife's an environmental educator, for instance, and they will tell you, like, kids, it is harder and harder to get them outside because of usually technology. I mean, it's a lot more fun to be inside when there are awesome games to play. And also, you know, our built spaces are actually getting more and more comfortable, and outside is hot and buggy and all these other things that people just haven't learned to tolerate and or appreciate. And so when you look at Pokemon Go by itself, I think, you know, I feel confident saying that it's something that I feel is fairly benign. Like, it neither is something that I'm worried about or should be. But when you look at this broader context and this broader trend, you know, I do think there's, like, slippery slope of our, you know, I don't want to say there's a right way and a wrong way to enjoy being outside, but I can tell you that if all you're doing is looking at your phone, what's it matter? How is that any different from being inside versus being outside?
Right.
You know what's really interesting to me about this, which is that augmented reality on your phone is probably the first step towards something that is actually a lot cooler. I mean, this was like where we had Google Glass.
Yep.
So I think one of the issues that people struggle with is the image of a person craned over their phone and looking at a small world that's placed within this larger world, you know, this little screen.
The real world.
In front of the big universe, right? And instead of having lenses that go over your eyes, it feels like people right now with augmented reality are kind of still just looking at their phones.
And I was just going to say, I don't think that's quite true, because there is something to me that feels a little weird, too, about you know, if say you go to the top of Mount Washington and there are all these people who just got off the Cog Railway and they're wearing Oculus Rift.
Oculus VR.
And it's because the view up there is not good enough and they need like a dragon to be flying over, too. And it's sort of like, what's wrong with that? You know, maybe I'm just being normative. I'm applying my norms to those people. But at the same time, there are so many problems that you know, I as like an environmental journalist look at, and it seems to me that people don't care about them, right? And that's like what we sort of like wring our hands about. People don't care about these problems, and if you can't even get people to pay attention without some sort of dragon flying through, it seems like they're missing the point.
Yeah,
I think my response to that would be, you're misconstruing technology for an outcome as opposed to a tool. And if I were an enterprising environmental reporter, I'd be trying to figure out how I could use Pokemon Go to further my agenda of getting people to engage with, you know, if you go to an endangered habitat, how do I get Pokemon Go to make a Pokemon Go spot or whatever they're called, like a place for me to go and, you know, like I get points when I go there.
Yeah, and I disagree with like the whole fundamental premise, which is that I think if you look at the people who don't care about some of these important environmental issues, you're going to find that demographic is much wider than gamers.
Well, and so here's what I actually mentioned this to you in a tweet to you, that the question is like, where are we going as a culture, right? And I don't think that Pokemon Go is in of itself, you know, a harbinger of the end times, but it's sort of like, it's like a step along a path. but it does, I do wonder, right, if it's some sort of step along a path into a place where it's just impossible to get people to go out and see the world as it is and appreciate that world.
I think that's absolutely true. That is absolutely my concern. And it's a slippery slope. Like, I just recently started listening to podcasts like Outside In. But I noticed that I pay much less attention to what's around me. I don't like hear birds. I don't feel things as much. I'm like in my head thinking about what's on my device and what's in my ears. And I'm totally disconnected from the actual beauty and the actual space around me. And that is not good. That I don't think that's good for my mind. I don't think it's good for my emotions. I don't think it's good for my connection to place. And if you don't feel connected to a place, you don't care about it in the long run.
Well, that's where I have to like disagree on that. You know, it's when you're out there enjoying nature, you're already applying a million filters, right? So you're, you know, before you said, I want to know if it's a, you know, what was the bird you referenced? I forget. You want to know if it was
a yellow belly sapsucker.
And like, I don't know, what does that even mean to be yellow belly sapsucker? That's a human construct that we're applying onto the frickin' natural world for a beautiful little brown bird or whatever it is with a yellow belly. And that's, we're already doing that. Every single day, all day, we're applying our own human constructs to the outside world. And so to arbitrarily draw this line saying like, okay, well, my brain is doing it, so that's okay, but my phone is doing it, so that's not okay, I think that's pretty arbitrary.
All right, so here's what I think. I think, Maura, you have to download Pokemon Go. You have to try it. She's making a face that's suggesting she's
take
not going to.
Take it on your jog. Yeah. You're already there.
you'll look at herself.
I'll fall over my feet.
And then, Gray, we're going to go on a hike with nothing but like sandals that we are strapped on.
No, I want it. No shoes, no lights, no tents.
Okay.
Just us and constellations, which we don't know the names of.
Right, okay. And then we're just going to call it a truce.
Perfect.
That's Sam Evans Brown. He's host of NHPR's podcast, Outside In. And you can hear the full conversation when you subscribe to the Outside In podcast on iTunes and Google Play. And we would love to know what you think. Is Pokemon a useful tool for getting people outside? Or a symptom of a weakening appreciation for the natural world? You know, the one without the monsters. You can join the conversation on facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today's 10-Minute Writers Workshop talks to former U.S. and New Hampshire Poet Laureate Donald Hall. At 87, he is not writing poetry anymore because, as he puts it, it's a young man's game. But he does continue to write daily at the home that he shared with the poet Jane Kenyon, Eagle Pond Farm in Wilmot, New Hampshire. And that's where we found him.
This is the 10-Minute Writers Workshop with Donald Hall.
Donald Hall, which is harder for you to write? Is it the first sentence or the last?
Actually, often the first sentence ends up as the beginning of the poem. If so, that would be easiest, because I don't write, I revise. And if a poem starts with a sudden insight, the beginning is less apt to change. I've had experiences where, you know, I've written a long draft and it turns out to be three different poems. In the essays I published recently, three of them took 85 drafts. That was not true when I was 28, you know. But I love to revise.
Do you do that as you go along, or do you wait till you have a draft and then you edit it?
Every day I have a new draft, and my typist will number them. I number them so that I can always, if I have a pile of them, I can tell which are first. But actually, I do it mostly so that I can brag, so that I can tell you, I did 85 drafts with poems. And one poem that went 400, but mostly the poems would go 80 to 110.
What did that poem that went to 400 revisions become? Do you recall?
It never worked. I publish it. It's a poem called Another Elegy. But I publish it, but I have not reprinted it. Boy, oh boy.
What is your worst distraction from getting your work done?
Now that I'm 87, I don't write poems anymore. Let me talk about the past while I was writing everything. I would work on poems first thing in the day, every day. Christmas Day, just to make sure I could brag about it. And I would work as much as 2 hours. I'd work on many poems at once. I would stop when one or two things happened. If I got really tired in the language, with this kind of language, I would stop. Don't force it after that point. Okay. But the other thing is sometimes I would get too excited. I would be changing everything rapidly, and I would realize I'm hyper, I'm manic, this isn't going to be any good, and I'd stop. Every now and then there'd be a day when I would look at poems, open up my collections, and wouldn't do work at all. So I would be distracted by inability, or sometimes by what seemed to be glibness.
Glibness?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So after all these decades of writing, are there habits that you picked up, tactics to get it done in a way that felt authentic and productive?
I emphasize revision, as I talk to you, and I think I always have. I got serious about writing when I was 14, and nobody told me anything about writing. I would work on a poem. It would be something terrible, you know. I'd be wandering the city streets alone at midnight with deep burning eyes. But I would finish it, and then I would, you know what I'd do? I'd go back to the beginning and start doing it over again.
Wow.
I didn't do 85 drafts back then, but I did start with revision for me. It's not true for everybody. The doorway into a poem is the sound it makes. My first poet, quickly superseded, was Edgar Allan Poe. You can't help but hear the noise. That was there at the beginning. I was trying with sound, and sound was my doorway.
Are there books or other tools or, you know, essays, people writing about writing that were helpful to you that you could recommend to others?
There were particular poets. I remember when I was 15 or 16, I found Hart Crane, who was difficult, but beautiful, and the sound was very beautiful. And I lived with him and his poetry. There was an anthology by Louis Untermeyer, which had poems, but also had a paragraph or so about the poet to begin with. And I would get fascinated by the life of the poet. And Hart Crane jumped off a boat in the Gulf of Mexico in his 30s, I think. And it was so romantic and horrible. That attracted me. And then the complexity of it. I was writing papers about it when I was in college still. I found the Romantics, I found Keats. But it was a while before I found the 17th century. And then I spent a lot of time there.
What do you think, even thinking back of yourself as a young, burgeoning writer, is the biggest mistake that a new writer makes?
Everything I wrote was a mistake in the sense that it was no good. I would think that a mistake would be to give up. I started sending poems to magazines when I was 14, and I was stupid enough or silly enough to tell the Nation that I was 14. And they said, well, if you're 14, you're pretty good. I was an only child, and my parents were glued in on me, and my mother in particular would say to me, okay, oh, there's a rejection today, Danny. Oh, good. What, you know, and if there was a rejection, one thing I learned to do for myself was get it back in the mail within an hour. And, first look at it and see if you can change it or you want to. Otherwise, get it back in. So you stop despairing and start hoping. I'm talking about being very young, of course.
But that's beautiful.
But then I did publish in magazines, not student magazines, magazine, when I was 16. I published 3 poems in inconsiderable magazines, but it was thrilling. I mean, I thought the phone was going to ring from Stockholm any minute. That was very exciting.
What's the best advice that you ever got about writing?
You know, I've known lots of poets, T.S. Eliot and Wallace Stevens and Robert Frost and Dylan Thomas and so on and so on. And I've talked about poetry with all of them. And I learned more about poetry by working with Henry Moore, the sculptor, and we talked about art and making art. And he talked about carving, and I will translate it into writing. He talked about size and scale a lot. Something could be huge. You'd think of sculpture, I'd be thinking of poem. And then there are things that could be quite small, where the scale is enormous. I have a little bronze maquette by Henry Moore right over there. And that is enormous in scale and 8 inches in size.
Donald Hall there, former U.S. and New Hampshire Poet Laureate and author of more than 50 books and collections. The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop was produced by Sarah Plourd with help from Maureen McMurray. And there is loads more advice on putting your creative muscles to work. Just hit the subscribe button wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed the podcast, give those muscles a stretch by writing a review. That makes it easier for others to find us. Well, we have to say goodbye for this Bastille Day. On n'a pas plus de temps pour aujourd'hui, un jour pour se souvenir des idées de liberté, d'égalité et de fraternité. Je suis Virginia Prescott. Nous serons de retour demain avec encore de bouche à l'oreille à 2h sur NHPR. Salut!